Good morning. Joseph Grube on behalf of the appellants. I'd like to, if I could, reserve 3 minutes to address rebuttal. The trial court in this case on remand after this court reversed a portion of an underlying judgment abused its discretion by refusing to grant a hearing on determining the net benefit, which is
They had a hearing. It was just without oral argument.
She made a decision, but she only there was only testimony other than one. I guess that's one way to look at it. But the only evidence submitted to the court as to what the net benefit was presented by the appellant in this case.
What new facts would have been produced if witnesses had been called?
I can only speculate as to what new facts would have been presented to the trial court by the respondents.
Well, what's your speculation? We know where they spent the money. We know that the interest rates weren't 12% in the marketplace. What else did the trial court need to know?
The trial court didn't needed to know, or perhaps subject to the examination of the respondents, whether or not the attorney's fees were refundable or not.
Why would that matter? I mean, basically, you're making an argument, if I spend my judgment, I don't have to pay it back. If I put it in the bank and don't spend it, I do have to pay it back. I have a real problem with that.
That's not really the argument we're making. For example,
well, what's wrong with that characterization of the argument?
Well, for example, when the appellants received this money, which was not pursuant to any collection, it wasn't pursuant to any process, it was voluntarily paid over after the first judgment, they were required to pay income tax.
Why is that a bad fact?
It goes to whether or not they're...
The briefing treats that like that's a bad fact, that when someone actually complies with a Superior Court judgment, they've done something that no reasonable person
no.
would do.
Well, I wouldn't mean to imply that.
I mean, that just can't be the law.
Correct,
even
Your Honor.
If it's how things happen.
That's not wrongful behavior on that specific portion of this case is not wrongful behavior on the part of the respondents. However,
I mean, it's more than just not wrongful. It's crazy.
I wish more people did that, I suppose, in the cases in which my clients get judgments. But it does go to the distinction of whether you're analyzing this under an unjust enrichment theory, whether it's an innocent recipient.
Well, your client didn't have to cash the check. The check could have been sent back and said, we don't want to run the risk that we face if there's a reversal, put it in the registry of the court, you can have a satisfaction of judgment then, and neither one of us is at risk at 12% interest.
Well, I don't think that's the position of the respondents in this case. I think they believe if they would have posted that money in the treasury, they would have still been entitled to 12% interest on that. But
certainly your clients wouldn't have had the use of the money.
Correct, but it is not incorrect for them to accept the judgment, and I think I cited that in our reply brief, that it is for a judgment creditor to accept funds paid under a judgment is not wrongful behavior either.
Well, I don't mean to suggest it's wrongful, but when we advise clients, we look at what the risks are and tell them about the alternate courses of action that they can take and what the consequences of those actions are down the road.
Sure, but the distinction, again, is whether it's an innocent recipient under unjust enrichment theory or a wrongful recipient, because those are the differences in determining what the remedy is. And when it's an innocent recipient, as it was in this case, by these judgment creditors or former judgment creditors, the analysis is what is the net benefit to their estate. That is, under RIP 12.8 and the restatement of restitution, that's the analysis. It's not necessarily exactly the amount they were paid. And this court has held that just because certain funds were paid, you don't just put a negative in front of that number and determine that that's now the reverse.
Do you have a case that says in deciding what's the appropriate amount of restitution, we look to see how the judgment creditor spent their money?
I believe those are cases cited in the brief, or at least in the restatement. We look to see whether the way they spent their money was a net benefit to their estate. For example, if they were to purchase a car or a home or something like that, you would look to that and say, well, look, you got a net benefit to this, paying taxes.
Why isn't discharge of a debt a net benefit?
Maybe could you ask that again, Your Honor?
Why isn't the discharge of a debt a net benefit?
Well, the debt would not exist. Let's take the specific example of taxes. That debt would not exist if they had not.
It's easily fixed with an amended tax return, and you're not outside the time period to fix that.
But
so let's go to the attorney's fees,
okay,
which is the big number. There's two scenarios here that seems to me. Either the attorney was owed the money regardless of the outcome, in which it's a simple discharge of debt, or it's a contingent fee dependent upon the amount of recovery, and the attorney has to disgorge what was not part of the net recovery at the end of the day. And in either way, I don't understand why your argument carries any water.
Well, the whether or not the attorney's fees, the court didn't analyze the fee agreement or the contract between the parties.
I don't think it needs to, as I've just explained. Either the attorney doesn't get the full fee after the reversal, or it was a debt just like any other debt the judgment creditor had, which happened to be paid out of this fund rather than a bank account.
Well, I don't think the record supports that those are the only two options, Your Honor. The fee agreement
What's
is
the third option?
The third option is that those funds were payable and were not refundable pursuant to the contract between the attorney and...
So you're telling me that someone could have a contingent fee contract that required payment out of that fund but didn't take into account that there was a later court decision that reduced the amount of the fund?
I think that could be a reasonable interpretation, but I also think it
would,
just can't be decided...
Would you want to defend that under the RPCs as a reasonable fee?
Your Honor, I think it just... that is not in the record right now, and it's hard to speculate on that, but that should have at least been allowed.
It's very hard to speculate that you would charge somebody $240,000 for a $10,000 recovery on a contingent fee basis.
Well, I don't think that's what happened in this case, Your
Honor.
Well,
I'm not suggesting what did or didn't happen. What I'm suggesting is it doesn't matter.
Okay. If I could move on just to the other issue, because it's not just the attorney's fees issue. This interest rate, which was arbitrarily decided by the court as an equitable interest rate of 5%, is also in violation of the principles of restitution, which is it's an equitable decision. And this court has very recently held that, and so has our Supreme Court, that when a court makes an equitable decision or a trier of fact is required to use its discretion, the prejudgment interest is not permitted. And in this case, the court didn't do that. It simply... Instead of applying the 12% sought by the respondents, or the 0% or 0.5%, which was pointed out to the court by the appellants, pulled out of the air 5% and said that's what it's going to be, an equitable rate. There's no, I've not been able to find that that's some sort of...
You frequently let courts choose between expert opinions and a number in between. If the range is 0 to 12 and the court comes out somewhere in between, why is it an abuse of discretion?
There was no opinion or evidence before that trial court as to any rate of interest other than 0.5%.
Howard, a good friend, again, representing the respondents and cross-appellants, Name Intelligence and Jay Westerdahl. Hamilton Gardner, who is trial counsel, is with me at counsel table today. The trial court did exactly what RAP 12.8 says and actually directs it to do. It says the court, quote, shall enter orders and authorize the issuance of process appropriate to restore to the party any property taken from that party. The judgment was paid, but the fact that it was voluntarily satisfied does not make the judgment debtors mere volunteers. The restatement, most recent one, restatement third restitution, section 18, makes clear that a judgment paid in satisfaction of a judgment, even voluntarily, is one under compulsion of legal process. And the courts identified very good reasons why that is the rule.
If the plaintiffs had insisted that the judgment be paid into the registry of the court rather than accepting it, would your client still be entitled to interest on the repayment of the money from the registry?
I would take position, yes, they are.
And what rate?
At 12%.
And why?
Because in Washington, where a sum is liquidated, and there's no dispute that this sum is a liquidated sum, it's a definite sum of money, easily ascertainable, and a plaintiff is, or a party is entitled to prejudgment interest, that judgment interest is assessed at the judgment rate of 12%.
That's typically applied to the collection of a debt. If there's a debt owing as a result of a contract breach, for instance. This is not that. This isn't a legal claim. This is an equitable claim for restitution. So why doesn't the nature of the remedy follow from it being equitable? And then why wouldn't that give the court the opportunity to vary the rate of interest, even if the entitlement to interest would necessarily follow from the rule?
Well, I'm unaware of any authority in the state, with the sole exception...
Sometimes that's what we do here.
I understand.
So my question is, why wouldn't it be?
Because the law is otherwise. And I'm going to cite you to Humphrey Industries.
Before you do that, this is supposed to be an equitable remedy, which means it's supposed to be fair. In the world financially that we live in, why is it fair to force a 12% interest obligation on someone who doesn't take use of the money?
Well, there's two reasons. One is the Supreme Court has basically always said that that's what the rate is when it's a liquidated sum.
It's always been.
That's one reason. It's
Brown versus Board of Education would suggest maybe we ought to go to the second one.
The other reason is the mischief that would accrue were the determination of the rate used for prejudgment interest based upon how a party used the funds when they had them wrongfully.
Well, they don't use them in my hypothetical, and the rate of return would be whatever the clerk invested them and realized on them. And certainly nobody would claim that your client, with a prudent, safe investment, would have realized 12% during this period of time.
Well, perhaps in your example, Judge Leach, when a party pays the money into the registered court, that's all you get, is whatever the interest rate was earned.
I'm trying to suggest a way plaintiffs in the position of these plaintiffs could avoid the risks that they found themselves exposed to. I mean, it just strikes me that they can't be in a position where they're always going to pay 12% if they win a trial and lose on appeal. There's got to be some way to hedge that.
The way they can hedge it is by entering into an agreement, a forbearance agreement pending appeal. I mean, that's one way to do it, and you suggested it. Let me answer in terms of the practical consequences of your suggestion that the rate of interest will be based upon how a party uses the funds. Are you going to have a hearing every time there's a liquidated sum about how the funds that were wrongfully withheld from the party that's entitled to them were used? What if those funds were invested in Apple and they generated 300% returns? Would we get the benefit of that? That is not what the law provides, and that's not what...
You're speaking to a different question than I believe the question that was posed by Judge Leach, but that notwithstanding... Speak to my question.
I will.
Typically, prejudgment interest is viewed as, unsurprisingly, interest on the actual debt that's accrued. Under RAP 12.8, however, it appears that prejudgment interest is actually an element of that which should be awarded. It's actually part of the base sum, because the rule presupposes that putting the party back as close as they would be to the position they were in, it seems to presuppose that the amount that's refunded might be greater than the amount that was actually paid initially. If that's so, why doesn't that constitute the difference that takes it away from this statutory tether to the 12%, but rather it's in essence an element of the damage of complying with the contract?
I think that might be true in cases where there, for instance, an A&W seed, where there is a sale of property. And, you know, those are the appropriate circumstances that RAP 12.8 talks about, where there has to be a determination of, well, we can't restore, in the words of the rule, the property that was taken from that party. Where you have a liquidated sum of money, and it doesn't matter whether it's on a note or on a restitutionary claim under RAP 12.8. It is a liquidated sum, and in Washington, that's how we do it. We don't do it as the federal courts do in admiralty cases, where you find a rate that's fair. And in fact, in Wright v. Dave Johnson, Division III basically said that. Just because you think the statutory rate is too high, you can't just say it's an equitable rate. In Wright v. Dave Johnson, Division III reversed the trial court because the trial court made a finding that a lower rate on a liquidated sum in a restitutionary claim was fair, that 12% was not. That finding alone was insufficient to justify ignoring the statutory rate of interest in Washington on a liquidated sum of money. So I think in answer to your question, Judge Dwyer, there are appropriate circumstances where a court has to determine what the net benefit is. When property is sold at execution, you're only going to get not its fair market value, but its reasonable value that it fetched at a sheriff's sale. There might be a case where there is no prejudgment interest on that sum. But where here, you're restoring to the party the precise sum of money that was paid in satisfaction of the judgment. It is a liquidated sum, and in Washington, we use the statutory rate of interest, unless there are specific findings, and this, I think, has only been applied in marital dissolution cases that require specific findings why that 12% rate is inequitable. Just by saying 5% is an equitable rate of interest does not satisfy the law.
If there had been findings supporting it based on returns available in the marketplace and that sort of thing, would your position be different?
No, because that rule has only been applied in marital dissolution cases, not in restitutionary cases. And Humphrey Industries from the Supreme Court is a CR 11 judgment that was reversed, that was paid back, and to which 12% interest applied. Dave Johnson was...
You're basically saying there is no equitable authority in the trial court in this context with respect to the interest rate.
Not under current law. And I would suggest that if this court wants to make that rule, it would have to look very seriously at why Wright v. Dave Johnson is different and why Humphrey Industries is different. And it would have to distinguish the very steady line of authority. I'm talking about taxes that were wrongfully paid, development fees that are refunded. In each of those scenarios, 12% prejudgment interest is applied consistently, and those cases are cited in our brief. That's the rule here, and, you know, it might have been a great rule when interest rates were 20% and a harsh rule when interest rates are 1%, but that's the rule in the state of Washington, and it should have been applied here. If the court doesn't have any questions, we ask that the court affirm on the restitution and reverse on the interest rate that was set by the trial court. Thank you.
It is disputed that the sums were not liquidated in the sense that it is the trial court's, it's not a matter of right under 12.8. This court has made that clear.
The amount the defendant paid was liquidated, wasn't it?
Right, but the amount that the defendant's entitled to back is under the rule, dependent on what the trial court awards, is just. That is the rule. It's not a per se. I mean, I believe Vasani says that in the other cases. So it's not liquidated until that trial court makes a decision. And that requires its discretion. And regardless of whether that discretion was abused, prejudgment interest on an unjust enrichment on a case where it requires discretion is not permissible until that discretion has been exercised and that amount then becomes liquidated by the trial court. We're not contesting post-judgment interest or anything once the trial court makes that decision. The amount of restitution, if the amount of restitution under an unjust enrichment approach requires the fact finder to weigh all of the circumstances to determine what amount the payee was unjustly enriched, then it's not subject to prejudgment interest. It wasn't a loan. It wasn't a forbearance. It seems to, and again, the rule, RAP 12.8, does say to look to the restatement of restitution and unjust enrichment. Unjust enrichment should not leave an innocent recipient worse off than if the transaction had never taken place. But under the respondent's theory, it would every time.
What mental process did the trial court have to go through to determine the underlying amount, separating out that amount of that was assigned to prejudgment interest? But what mental process did the trial court have to go through to determine that amount other than arithmetic?
It also had to do with whether or not, because we don't concede that what was filed in the respondent's rebuttal papers, that the taxes are refundable under all circumstances or there was enough time. I know that, I think it was you, Your Honor, who said that, but that wasn't addressed, it wasn't argued, it was...
No, they filed a declaration from a CPA. Did you file any contravening declaration?
I believe that declaration was filed in rebuttal. I don't know that we had an opportunity to, and we never got a hearing, but I don't, that the record will reflect.
Do you have 3 years to file an amended return?
As I tell my clients, Your Honor, I'm not trying to be cute. I'm not a tax lawyer, so I don't
address that. Okay, well, then dealing with that, which we always try to deal with, which is actually the record here. The
sure.
Record is from a CPA. There's 3 years to file an amended return.
Well, I think the court also...
What processes did the court here have to go through other than arithmetic?
Look at, for example, believing the declarations of my clients that they either got 0% interest or 0.018% interest or 0.5% interest on these funds that they actually segregated and held in an account.
Well, now you're answering a different question.
Oh, okay.
That goes to the prejudgment interest question. I'm talking about the base amount.
Well, I think the court also equitably determining whether it was a reasonable attorney fee, sort of intimated by Judge Leach, but whether or not it was refundable or not under the terms of the fee agreement and the terms of the contract of the parties.
Those are legal questions. Those aren't discretionary decisions. The court's making legal rulings that taxes didn't matter and that the attorney fee didn't matter. Go ahead and answer my question if you can.
Your Honor, I don't know that I can.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.